Genesis 23 through 24, the 25th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 15, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
With all these microphones, you'd hear my every heartbeat. We're in the middle of Genesis. Genesis chapter 23, and my plan is to do Genesis 23 and 24 today. That'll probably keep us moving. We're in a section where, in Genesis, where Abraham is kind of fading out. He's passing from the scene. As I mentioned last week, the development of Abraham happens between chapter 12 of Genesis and chapter 22. And those two chapters are very similar, and I think they're intended to be very similar, indicating that that's the beginning and the end of that part of Genesis. But Abraham didn't die in chapter 22. He goes on living. In fact, he goes on living for a long time. But we don't follow him anymore. He's kind of fading out, stepping into the background, and his son Isaiah is going to step to the fore. And part of that transition is made in these two chapters. In chapter 23, we have the death of Sarah. So it's Abraham dealing with death. And then in the next chapter, it is Abraham making provision for Isaac to marry, to get a wife. So there it's Abraham making provision for the future. So these two chapters, I think, are both transitional chapters, moving on to Abraham stepping back and Isaac stepping to the fore. So let's read chapter 23. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is, Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Then Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, Hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth. And he spoke with them, saying, If it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and approach Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is in the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site. Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Seth, even of all who went in at the gate of his city, saying, No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. And Abraham bowed before the people of the land. And he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, If you will only please listen to me, I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there. Then Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between me and you? So bury your dead. And Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field, that were within all the confines of its border, were deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth, before all who went in at the gate of his city. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah his wife in the cave of the field at Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth. So Sarah, Abraham's wife, dies at the age of 127 years old. She lived a long time. That's a very long time. Should we take these numbers literally? If you look throughout Genesis, it's oftentimes tempting to try to find some symbolic significance for the numbers. You'll see numbers repeated, such as 40. 40 is repeated very often. 120 is a number that we saw associated with the length of the life of man after, or just before the flood. God talks about that. 7 is a significant number. It's a number that shows up several times. Should we see 7 as being symbolic? Do we have here 120 plus 7? Well, it is tempting to try to find symbolic meanings for these numbers, because 127 years is a long time for someone to live. Abraham lives, I think Abram's 175 or something. But every time I've tried to do that, if you work it out in the chronology in Genesis, the literal number works pretty well. The literal number seems to be one that we are to take seriously. So I'm just going to take this at face value. I suspect that what it's saying is Sarah lived 127 years, and then she died. I'm not inclined to find a symbolic meaning to it. She dies in Kiriath Arba. That's quite a ways north from Beersheba. In last chapter, it says that Abraham settled in Beersheba. And then later, we see that Isaac settles in Beersheba. So that seems to have been their base camp. But Abraham was semi-nomadic. He had livestock, and he lived in an area that was semi-desert. And so he's going to have to move in order to provide for his livestock. So apparently he ranged over quite a large area, ranged as far north as Hebron and as far south as Beersheba. In any case, it's in Hebron that Sarah dies. So Abraham wants to make burial plans for her. But he's got a problem. He wants to bury her someplace where he wants to have a permanent resting place, both for her and for himself and his family. But Abraham is a foreigner. He's just passing through. He is not a citizen anywhere. He doesn't have the rights to own property. So he has to go to the city, to the townspeople, and he has to get special permission to be able to buy land so he can bury Sarah, where he can be assured that she will stay, her remains will stay unmolested. So that's what he's trying to achieve here. Okay, so he goes to the Hittites of the city, and we have this exchange, and it's kind of an interesting exchange. It's hard to know what to make of it. He says, "I'd like this land," and they say, "You can have everything," and he says, "No, I just want this little plot." And they say, "Oh, well, just take it." And then he ends up paying 400 shekels for it. So what's going on here? Is this all formality? The formality in which a sale is done? Or are we to take this seriously? I think this is just formality. I think this is The thing I liken it to is buying a car. I mean, you know what's going to happen when you go in to buy a car. You go in to buy a car and you say, I'll pay X number of dollars worth for it. And your salesman says, well, that's awfully low, but since I'm such a good guy, I'll go do whatever I can to see if I can get you that price. And he goes away and he comes back and he says, well, my boss says that is $10,000 below the price that he pays for the car, that his break-even price. But since you're such a nice guy, he's willing to sell it to you for $5,000 less than break-even price. And then it goes on. So you know the ritual. Well, it's a similar kind of thing here, I assume. That what's going on here is, for the most part, formulaic. This is a set procedure. This is how you do a deal. And Abraham is just going through the deal. However, when it starts out, when in their initial address to him, they refer to him as a mighty prince among us. I suspect that they have genuine respect for Abraham. We've seen that Abimelech had genuine respect for him. There are others in Canaan that he has come in contact with that have had genuine respect for him. Melchizedek. And even the king of Sodom, I think, has a certain amount of respect for Abraham. So Abraham has established a reputation for himself. And that even the surrounding Canaanites acknowledge that he is, there's something special about Abraham. The words that they use literally are, you are a prince of God among us. Well, I don't think that the Hittites understood the relationship that Abraham has with Yahweh, the creator of the universe. But I think that they are speaking better than they know. That when they say he's a prince of God among us, they're saying something that's even truer than the meaning that they're investing in it. And the author of Genesis has picked up on that and preserved it as being significant. Okay, so the Hittites say, yes, you can buy a plot. So there's a two-part process in this, in negotiation. The first is Abraham receives the right to possess property in their area. That was the first thing that he had to do, because he is not a citizen. He does not have the right of ownership. And one of the interesting things about Abraham is God has taken him away from where he would have had such rights in Mesopotamia, brought him to a new land where he has none of those rights. And he lives out his days without those rights. But here the Hittites are willing to make an exception. He can buy a piece, he can have a piece of land where he can bury his wife. Okay, so then Abraham wants to negotiate for a particular plot of land. And he says, I would like the piece of land, this cave at the back of this field, way out of the way, that's owned by Ephron. And Ephron comes forth and says, whatever is mine is yours, take it. I think that's formulaic. But what's Ephron, there's a little twist here. Ephron says, you can have the cave and the field. So Ephron is expanding. What Abraham had asked for is just the cave. Ephron says, you can have the cave and the field. Now, there's something tricky happening here. I'm not sure exactly what it is. But in later Hittite culture, we know that if you own a whole piece of land, a block of land, there are certain obligations that come with that. Tax-paying obligations, service to the king-type obligations, etc., etc. If you just own a small portion of that big block, the obligations that come with the property don't come with that little piece. So if Abraham buys just the little cave and not the whole block, he's getting just the cave, and he's not getting with it all of the obligations. We'll call them tax obligations that come with the block of land. So it would make sense that this guy wants to, if he's going to unload a part of the property, he may want to unload the whole thing and with it all of the obligations that are tied to it. So that may be what's going on here. In any case, Ephron tacks on the field as well with the cave. And Ephron says, you can have it, it's a gift. Well, again, I think this is just the ritual. I don't think he means it. And apparently such a custom continues among some peasant peoples in the Near East, in which you say, oh, I like your horse. And they'll say, oh, it's yours. And then you say, oh, well, I couldn't just take it from you. How much would it cost? And they say, $3,000. And then you have to negotiate down to a reasonable price. Well, apparently that's what's happening here. Abraham says, well, I couldn't just take it. I insist on buying it. And the answer is, well, what is a piece of property of worth only 400 dollars between you, 400 shekels between you and me? It's difficult to know whether 400 shekels is a lot of money or just a little bit of money at the time, but there's some indication that that's a pretty high price for this piece of property. That's out of the ordinary. So that's apparently what's happened here. This is a ritual that they've gone through, and he has offered this price, which is rather high, and in offering the price and making his statement, there's a little grammatical shift, change in word order that's kind of playing on Abraham's sorrows at this time of his wife's death. So Ephron is apparently trying to soak him a little bit here, taking advantage of the situation. How does Abraham respond? He says, fine, it's a deal. So Abraham starts out wanting to buy this little cave and ends up buying a block of land for an exorbitant price. He's my kind of businessman. I am heartened to see that Abraham, he has become a genuinely wealthy man. But there's no indication in the text it's because he was a shrewd businessman. Abraham is just living out his life, making bad deals, and God is blessing him. And I'm encouraged that God is able to overcome such liabilities if he chooses to do so. But Abraham, he's coming towards the end of his life. Money, I suspect as a result of his experiences, money kind of loses its glitter as Abraham grows older. It's not as big a deal as it would have been at an earlier time in his life. In any case, Abraham buys this plot of land for apparently a high price. So now Abraham, interestingly, for the first time has legal title to a piece of land in the land that God has promised to his heirs. It's very ironic that God has promised him this large area of land in Palestine. He has told Abraham that his descendants will possess Palestine, all of Palestine. And yet, Abraham, up until now, has owned not a single square inch of Palestine. And now he makes his first purchase. He has legal title to the first little piece of land, and it's a burial plot. nothing more significant than just a burial plot. It's just a place to put corpses. So it's only this little bit of this promise that God has made to Abraham that gets realized in his lifetime. And it gets realized through the most ordinary and mundane of means. He buys it. He goes to the city and he buys it. There are no miracles in how he comes to get this land. It's just a normal, ordinary process. And if you think about it, for the most part, when his descendants, the descendants of Abraham, come to possess the rest of the land, it is largely through rather ordinary means. Through conquest, through purchase, through dispossession, but it's all through rather ordinary means over a very long period of time. And yet the promise that God made to Abraham is fulfilled, and his descendants do inhabit the land. So there's one sense in which this purchase of the land is just an ordinary detail of life, just like everything else. But there's another sense in which God's scheme of history is playing itself out behind this ordinary detail. God's scheme of history, God's plan for history, for the most part, is just the addition of all these ordinary things. It's just made up of the ordinary. If it wasn't, we wouldn't call it ordinary. And there's something really, really reassuring about that, because there's a tendency, at least in my mind, to divide life up into the ordinary and that part of life in which God is active. And I see God active here, but for the most part, it's just ordinary. It's just stuff going on. But in fact, they are completely merged. That God is working in the ordinary. And we shouldn't expect otherwise. And that's what he's doing here. Okay. Now, the next chapter is the longest chapter in Genesis. I'm not sure the significance of that, but it does make for a lot of reading. But my plan is to go through this chapter, and I will be doing a lot of reading. Forgive me for doing a lot of reading. Some of it is repetitive, but I did not write this, nor did I edit it. This was of someone else's composition. This is the story of Abraham providing for a wife for Isaac. Verses 1 through 9. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, "Please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live, but you shall go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac." And the servant said to him, "Suppose the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came?" Then Abraham said to him, "Beware, lest you take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, 'To your descendants I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there." So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. So Abraham is making provision for his son to get married. His son needs to get married in order for the promises to be inherited. This is all part of what has been promised to God. and Abraham in his old age, and apparently this is taking place after Sarah has died. Abraham is making sure that this is taken care of. Now, Abraham understands that marriage is a unique relationship. And he would like to arrange for a marriage, because in marriage, it's two people becoming one to a degree that is unrivaled in the rest of human experience. It's two people merging their lives. And when two people merge their lives, it means making joint decisions. And joint decisions requires, if you're going to have harmony at all, it requires at least agreement on foundational values and principles. Without that kind of agreement, then it is very difficult to merge lives and come to joint decisions. Abraham understands this. He's been married a long time. And I'm sure that he understands this dynamic and the need for shared core values in a marriage. Well, he looks around at the population that surrounds him in Canaan, and he's aghast. They are immoral. They are lawless. And he's appalled at what he sees. Clearly, he was appalled at what he saw in Sodom and Gomorrah and what his nephew Lot went through and Lot's family. So he steps back and he says, a wife for my son, not from around here. So he thinks, well, where would I go? Where could I find a suitable wife for my son? And he thinks, well, back where I came from, at least they had better values. So he calls in his most responsible servant. And we don't know who it is. His name is not mentioned. But earlier in Genesis, if you will recall, when God said, your son will inherit, and Abraham at that time did not have any sons, he said, let Eleazar inherit. And Eleazar was his adopted son and a servant in his household. Well, it's possible, it's speculated that this is Eleazar, but we don't know. In any case, his most trusted servant is called in, and Abraham has two conditions. There are two things that he wants to achieve. He wants to get a wife for Isaac, but there are two things. One is, that wife must not be from around here. He says, I want you to go back to where we came from. Go back to our homeland and get someone from there, someone from among our relatives. So, it can't be a Canaanite. And the other is, Isaac can't leave here. If Isaac leaves here, he's going to want to stay back there. The chances are he'll end up staying back there, and he won't come back to the land that God has given to me. And it's important for Abraham that Isaac stay in this land that God has given to him. So those are the two conditions that have to be fulfilled. He explains this to the servant, has the servant take a solemn oath that he will carry this out. He does, however, give him the one escape clause. If she won't come back, then you're done. Your obligation has been fulfilled. We'll just call it a failed attempt, and you're off the hook. But Abraham is confident that God will help this servant find a wife. And in fact, Abraham says that God will send an angel ahead of him. Someplace in here. His angel, he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. Okay. Okay, next section, 10, 10 through 14. Then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. And he said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And by this I shall know that thou hast shown loving kindness to my master. So the servant makes this long trip. It doesn't tell us much about the trip. He takes 10 camels. They're loaded with supplies and gifts. He wants to demonstrate to this girl, whoever it is, that they aren't living in complete poverty out here. They may be out in the boondocks, but it isn't completely without luxuries. And the customary gifts that would have been associated with such an arrangement. So he's loaded up the camels and he takes off. To go from Hebron to Nahor would have taken about a month. So it's a long journey and he's got servants that are going along with him. But we hear nothing about the journey. They arrive, they go to the busiest place in town, probably, the well, at least at this time of day. So he goes to the kind of the city center. Now, I don't know what the servant is thinking, but he was told that and God would send his angel. It could very well be that the servant was expecting to actually see an angel, see something extraordinary that was going to give him guidance as to who is this girl? Who am I supposed to be taking back for Isaac? I mean, it's kind of a daunting assignment that he has been given. I've been around enough weddings to know that just how a wedding comes off is important to everyone, let alone who the bride is. So this is a rather daunting assignment that he's been given. How is he supposed to figure out who to take home? Well, the angel's not there, so what does he do? And what he does is he comes up with this, well, he prays this prayer. And it asks for the following things. One, that it happened today. He's not a patient man. Secondly, that he be able to identify which girl it is by this little scenario. He will say, may I have a drink to her? And she will say, sure, have a drink. And do you want me to water your camels while I'm at it? And by that, then, he is supposed to know that this is the girl that God has appointed for Isaac. There's an interesting way for him to determine who this girl should be. It is not entirely arbitrary. It is not like saying, may the girl who comes up with a mole on her left cheek be the one. It's not that arbitrary. What he comes up with is actually an interesting little test. It's the first one who shows significant, truly sacrificial hospitality. I read, this is a commentary, this is in a commentary by a Jewish author. He makes an interesting point, so I'll read it. The criteria that the servant establishes are aspects of nobility of character. The ideal wife must be hospitable to strangers, kind to animals, and willing to give of herself to others. The grueling nature of the prescribed test can be appreciated only if it is realized that a single camel, and here there were 10, requires at least 25 gallons of water to regain the weight it loses in the course of a long journey. It takes a camel about 10 minutes to drink this amount of water. So what's being required here is a significant amount of work. She's going to be dumping out 250 gallons of water. That's a lot of water. That's a significant chunk of work. What's interesting about this is if you think back to the complaint that God had about the people of Sodom, it essentially was their lack of hospitality. If you will recall, when the angels came down to visit, to see if the outcry that had gone up from Sodom, if it was true, first they come and visit Abraham. And as you will recall, as soon as they arrive, Abraham starts scurrying around, preparing a meal for him and doing all the and washing their feet. He does all of the acts of hospitality that could have been expected. He's very generous and hospitable. Then those angels leave Abraham and they go to Sodom. And there, Lot comes and corrals them and says, "Hurry, come to my house." Why? Because the people of Sodom are not hospitable. And in fact, he knows that the people of Sodom will take advantage of them, will molest them. And that's why he takes them to his house. So it's the opposite of hospitality. So one of the key charges against the Canaanites is their lack of hospitality. The servant, when he goes to find a suitable wife for Isaac, knowing that Abraham was insistent that he not marry a Canaanite, has set up this little scenario that would require the kind of hospitality that is characteristic of his master. So it's not an arbitrary test that he has set up. It's actually a very shrewd test. Okay, the next section, 15 through 27. And it came about before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. And the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please, let me drink a little water from your jar." And she said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw. And she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. Then it came about, when the camels had finished drinking, that the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her wrists weighing 10 shekels in gold, and said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" And she said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Again she said to him, "We have plenty of both straw and feed, and room to lodge in." Then the man bowed low and worshipped the Lord, and he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers." Okay, so the narrator helps us out a little bit here and gives us information before the servant gets it. And that is, we learn with Rebecca's, right from her appearance, when she first shows up, that she is related to Abraham, that she is beautiful, and that she is an unmarried virgin. Now, the beautiful part he could probably tell. I don't know if he could tell if she was unmarried or not. I don't know if there would have been distinctive clothing or something that would have indicated that. But he didn't know that she was related to Abraham. So we have a little information that the servant didn't have. The servant is watching while Rebecca goes through performing the very things that he had asked. She does them one by one. She gives him a drink of water. Then she asks if he wants him to water the camels. And then she busies herself doing that. And she seems to be doing it with pleasure, not out of mere formality, but she seems to be genuinely wanting to do it. But the servant must be standing back and thinking, is this God's hand? Is he fulfilling the request that I had made in the prayer to him or not? And it's an interesting verse, 21. It says, meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. He had told God, please let it be this way, that the girl who does these things, she's the one. But he has no way of knowing whether God's going to honor that. So he's sitting back and watching and trying to determine, is this God's answer to my prayer or is it not? He concludes that it is. He gives her gifts, and then he asks if there's room for them to lodge there, and she says, sure, we got lots of room. And at that point, he seems to be pretty confident this God is at work here. God has indicated who the woman is that I'm to take back for Isaac. And he gives a prayer of thanksgiving. And he gives away a piece of information in that prayer of thanksgiving, and that is that his master is related to this girl. Okay, the next section, 28 through 49. Then the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban, and Laban ran outside to the man at the spring. And it came about that when he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrists, and when he heard the words of Rebekah his sister saying, this is what the man said to me, he went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. And he said, come in, blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside, since I have prepared the house and a place for the camels? So the man entered the house. Then Laban unloaded the camels, and he gave straw and feed to the camels, and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. But when food was set before him to eat, he said, I will not eat until I have told my business. And he said, speak on. So he said, I am Abraham's servant, and the Lord has greatly blessed my master so that he has become rich, and he has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and servants and maids and camels and donkeys. Now Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master in her old age, and he has given him all that he has. And my master made me swear, saying, you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughter of the Canaanites, in whose land I live, but you shall go to my father's house and to my relatives and take a wife for my son. And I said to my master, suppose the woman does not follow me. And he said to me, the Lord, before whom I have walked, will send his angel with you to make your journey successful. And you will take a wife for my son from my relatives and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my relatives. And if they do not give her to you, you will be free from my oath. I came today to the spring and said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, if now thou wilt make my journey on which I go successful, behold, I am standing by the spring, and may it be that the maiden who comes out to draw and to whom I say, please let me drink a little water from your jar, and she will say to me, you drink, and I will draw for your camels also. Let her be the woman whom the Lord has appointed for my master's son." Before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder and went down to the spring and drew. And I said to her, "Please let me drink." And she quickly lowered her jar from her shoulder and said, "Drink, and I will water your camels also." So I drank, and she watered the camels also. Then I asked her and said, "Whose daughter are you?" And she said, "The daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore to him." And I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her wrists. And I bowed low and worshipped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had guided me in the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. So now, if you are going to deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me, and if not, let me know, that I may turn to the right hand or to the left." Okay, so Rebekah runs back to the house. She apparently quickly tells Laban what's happened, gives him the short version of the exchange that's happened. Says, "I can't eat until I've taken care of business." And at that point, he tells them what's going on, what his mission is, and what has happened. And in his account of what has happened, he goes out of his way to highlight all the ways in which, one, Abraham and Isaac are blessed, so this is a good place for her to come, and two, all of the indications that Rebekah is the one that God has appointed for Isaac's wife. And apparently, it would appear that Rebekah's father must be dead, because it says that she goes to her mother's house, and Laban is there. Laban is the one who negotiates then with the servant. So apparently Rebekah's father is dead. So it's just her oldest brother and her mother who are involved in the negotiations. And the servant says, "This is the deal. Are you going to let her come with me or not? Give me the answer now." And we get the answer in the next section, verse 50. "Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, 'The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you, take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken.' And it came about, when Abraham's servant heard their words, that he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. And the servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. Then he and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night. When they arose in the morning, he said, 'Send me away to my master.' But her brother and her mother said, 'Let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10. Afterwards she may go.' And he said to them, 'Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master.' And they said, 'We will call the girl and consult her wishes.' Then they called Rebekah and said to her, 'Will you go with this man?' And she said, 'I will go.' Thus they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse with Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, 'May you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them.'" So Laban and Bethuel, they hear the account that the servant has given, and they say, "There's no question about it. This is God's leading. What can we say? There's no decision to be made here. She is the one for Isaac. She's the one to go with you." So it's a done deal. He gives them a bunch of gifts. But then they ask that she be allowed
to stay a little longer. They want to have time to say their goodbyes. Let her stay another 10 days so that they can thoroughly say their goodbyes. The servant says, I want to be on my way. I'm in a hurry. And they say, well, we'll leave it up to Rebecca to decide. And they ask her, and her decision is, I'm ready to go. So she's not going reluctantly. This is something that she is obviously eager to do. So they send her away with their blessing, and the blessing, interestingly, has basically two parts. May you become thousands of ten thousands, which is a similar promise that was made to Abraham, that his descendants would be without number. And may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them. And Abraham had been made similar promises. The promise to Abraham was, God will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And God had promised Abraham to give him the land of Palestine. Okay, so they take off. The last part. Then Rebekah arose with her maids, and they mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahai Roy, and he was living in the Negev. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. And she said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field to meet us? And the servant said, he is my master. Then she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife. And he loved her, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So the caravan arrives in the area where Isaac is living. Isaac looks out. He's looking out in the field, and he sees the caravan coming, and Rebekah with the caravan sees Isaac and jumps down off the camel, asks the servant who that is. It's Isaac. And so she puts on her veil. They get closer. And the servant apparently takes Isaac aside and fills him in on all the details, everything that's happened. And in Isaac's mind, apparently, there's no doubt, but what this is, this is the way it's meant to be, and they are married. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Isaac was an only son of Sarah. They were probably very close. Sarah has died, and now there's that hole left in his life, and Rebekah then becomes his comfort in the absence of his mother. Okay, just a couple of comments here. I am tempted to write a book, The Prayer of Eliezer. And I have envisioned this children's version and this video series and some other things. And it's a way of praying for direction from God and making sure that you know when God has given you that direction. But I'm reluctant for three reasons. This is a rather unique situation. I mean, you think about yourself in the servant's sandals. I mean, what is he supposed to do? How is he supposed to locate this girl that God has appointed for Isaac. That's a very daunting task. How would you do it? There's not a good rational way to make that determination beyond any question. So what he does is he comes up with this, God, let these things happen. But those make a lot of sense. The little scenario that he set up was actually a kind of test of character. And it made some sense. It fit with the assignment that he had been given. But the servant, even having asked God to do this thing, knew that there was no guarantee that God was going to come through and follow the scenario that he had charted out. It makes sense to me that God honored his prayer here. There have been times in my life when I have done similar kinds of things. God, if you want me to do X, let these things happen. And they did happen. And I'm confident that X was what he wanted me to do. But I can tell you at least as many times, if not more, when I tried to set up the same thing, and clearly God did not come through and provide me the kind of information that I wanted on my terms. What has become very clear to me is that God can be very accommodating at times. There are times when I need some direction, or I need comfort, or I need reassurance, or there are all kinds of things that I can need from God, and sometimes quite desperately so. And I cry out to God for that kind of help, and he provides it. And sometimes, even under rather juvenile circumstances, sometimes a kind of throwing out a fleece like Gideon does elsewhere in Scripture. And I think there have been times when God has honored that in my life as well. So there are times when we can be rather juvenile in our requests to God and the way that we make our requests to God. But God is a great God, and there are times when he condescends, and I mean that in a good sense of the word, not in the bad sense of the word, that he meets us on our own terms. He's willing to do that. And he meets the requests that we have placed upon him. However, God is very resistant to being manipulated by us. And we can take that God's willingness to accommodate us and take advantage of that and say, okay, let's set up another one. If the sun rises tomorrow, then that means God's going to give me $1,000. And then the sun comes up and we hold that over God's head. You promised. Are you going to let me down? And there are all kinds of ways that we can use God's graciousness as a way of trying to be manipulative of God. And as a result, he's very resistant to being put into those kinds of molds. There are other times when I have been very desperate for God's comfort and guidance, and prayed for God's comfort and guidance, and didn't get it, at least didn't get it the way that I wanted it, and didn't get it when I wanted it. God's a big God. God works in strange ways. God is working on all kinds of things at all kinds of times, and we don't even know what all he's doing. So we can't lay out a method, the prayer of Eleazar. I'm confident it cannot be laid out. There are times when it is a fine thing to do, to pray this kind of prayer, to get direction and guidance from God. But even in the midst of that prayer, we have to recognize God may do it and he may not. And he's still God, it doesn't matter. Either way, it doesn't matter, he's still God. We have to allow God to work the way that he's going to work. We are at his mercy and we are at his bidding. And if we ever lose sight of that, then we've inverted the relationship and we're trying to make ourselves the one in control rather than him the one in control. I have run over. So let's pray briefly and we'll skip questions. We'll be done. But save your questions for later. Father, I thank you very much for your graciousness towards us. We are strange and ignorant creatures in many respects. We are very juvenile. And we are bumblers. It is very difficult for us to know how to live life wisely. We have to be very grateful to you for the guidance that you do provide and the way that you are able to overcome our weaknesses and that you are able to accomplish your purposes in our lives despite our incompetence and our foolishness. We count on your grace in so very, very many ways. And we thank you that you are gracious. Continue to be gracious towards us. Continue to work through the very mundane and ordinary events of our lives to bring about your purposes. And help us to become mature, wise, and obedient servants of you. In Jesus' name, amen.